This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Prydain Chronicles, Volume 3, The Castle of Lear, by Lloyd Alexander. Read for you by James Langton.
Author's Note by Lloyd Alexander. In this chronicle of Prydain, following the Book of Three and the Black Cauldron, what befalls the heroine is as important and perilous as the hero's own quest. Princess Ailanwy of the Red Gold Hair does much more than face the unavoidable, and in her view absolutely unnecessary, ordeal of becoming a young lady. As Dalban, the old enchanter, warns, "For each of us comes a time when we must be more than what we are." And this holds true for princesses as well as for assistant pig-keepers. The Castle of Lear is, in a sense, more romantic than the preceding chronicles. Taran is noticeably aware of his feelings toward Ailanwy, and it is sometimes more comic. For example, the utter despair of the companions in trying to cope with the well-meaning but hapless Prince Rune. The mood perhaps is bittersweet, rather than grandly heroic, but the adventure should hold something beyond the fairy-tale elements of a magic golden bauble, a vengeful queen, a mysterious castle, and rivals for the hand of a princess. The nature of fantasy allows happenings which reveal most clearly our own frailties and our own strengths. The inhabitants of Prydain are fantasy figures. I hope they are also very human. Prydain itself, however, is entirely imaginary. Mona, background for the Castle of Lear, is the ancient Welsh name of the island of Anglesey. But this background is not drawn with a mapmaker's accuracy. My hope, instead, is to create the feeling, not the fact, of the land of Wales and its legends. Some readers may indignantly question the fate of several villains in this tale, especially that of one of the most reprehensible scoundrels in Prydain. I should point out that while the Castle of Lear, like the previous books, can stand as a chronicle in its own right, certain events in it have far-reaching consequences. Beyond that, I will hit no further, but only recommend one of the more difficult virtues, patience.
Chapter 1. Prince Rune. Ailanwy of the Red Gold Hair, the Princess Ailanwy, daughter of Angarad, daughter of Rigat, of the royal house of Lear, was leaving Caer Dalban. Dalban himself had so ordered it, and though Taran's heart was suddenly and strangely heavy, he knew there was no gainsaying the old enchanter's words. On the spring morning set for Ailanwy's departure, Taran saddled the horses and led them from the stable. The princess, looking desperately cheerful, had wrapped her few belongings in a small bundle slung from her shoulder. At her neck hung a fine chain and crescent moon of silver. On her finger she wore a ring of ancient craftsmanship, and in the fold of her cloak she carried another of her most prized possessions, the golden sphere that shone at her command with a light brighter than a flaming torch. Dalban, whose face was more careworn than usual, and whose back was bowed as though under a heavy burden, embraced the girl at the cottage door.
"You shall always have a place in Caer Dalban," he said, "and a larger one in my heart. But, alas, raising a young lady is a mystery beyond even an enchanter's skill. I have had," he added with a quick smile, "difficulties enough raising an assistant pig-keeper." "I wish you a fair voyage to the Isle of Mona," Dalban went on. King Rudlam and Queen Teleria are kindly and gracious. They are eager to stand in your family's stead and serve as your protectors. And from Queen Teleria, you shall learn how a princess should behave.
What? Cried Alanwi. I don't care about being a princess. And since I'm already a young lady, how else could I behave? That's like asking a fish to learn how to swim.
Hem, Dolwyn said wryly.
I have never seen a fish with skinned knees, torn robe, and unshod feet. They would ill become him, as they ill become you.
He set a gnarled hand gently on Ilanwy's shoulder.
Child, child, do you not see? For each of us comes a time when we must be more than what we are.
He turned now to Taran.
Watch over her carefully, he said. I have certain misgivings about letting you and Gergi go with her, but if it will ease your parting, so be it.
The Princess Ilan, we shall go safely to Mona, Taran answered.
And you, said Dalban, return safely. My heart will not be at ease until you do.
He embraced the girl again and went quickly into the cottage. It had been decided that Carl would accompany them to Great Avrin Harbour and lead back the horses. The stout old warrior, already mounted, waited patiently. Shaggy-haired Gergi, astride his pony, looked as mournful as an owl with a stomachache. Kor, the tame crow, perched in unwonted silence on Taran's saddle. Taran helped Ilanwy mount Luago, her favourite steed, then swung to the back of Melinlass, his silver-maned stallion. Leaving Caer Dalban behind, the little band set out across the soft hills toward Avrin. Side by side, Taran and Carl rode ahead of the others to lead the way, Kor, meanwhile, having made himself comfortable on Taran's shoulder. "She never stopped talking for a moment," Taran said gloomily. "Now at least it will be quieter in Caer Dalban."
"That it will," said Carl.
"And less to worry about. She was always getting into one scrape or another."
"That too," said Carl.
"It's for the best," Taran said. "Ilanwy is, after all, a princess of Lyr. It's not as if she were only an assistant pig-keeper."
"Very true,"
said Carl, looking off toward the pale hills. They jogged along silently for a while. "I shall miss her," Taran burst out at last, half angrily. The old warrior grinned and rubbed his shining bald head.
"Did you tell her that?"
Not exactly," faltered Taran. "I suppose I should have, but every time I began talking about it, I felt very odd. Besides, you never know what silly remark she'll come out with when you're trying to be serious."
"It may be," replied Carl, smiling. "We know least what we treasure most. But we will have more than enough to keep us busy when you come back, and you will learn, my boy, there is nothing like work to put the heart at rest."
Taran nodded sadly. "I suppose so," he said. Past midday they turned their horses to the west, where the hills began a long slope downward into the Avrin Valley. At the last ridge, Kor hopped from Taran's shoulder and flapped aloft, croaking with excitement. Taran urged Melinlass over the rise. Below, the great river swung into view, wider here than he had ever seen it. Sunlight flecked the water in the sheltered curve of the harbour. A long, slender craft bobbed at the shore. Taran could make out figures aboard, hauling on ropes to raise a square, white sail. Ilanwy and Gergi had also ridden forward. Taran's heart leapt. And to all the companions, the sight of the harbour and the waiting vessel was like a sea wind driving sorrow before it. Ilanwy began chattering gaily, and Gergi waved his arms so wildly he nearly tumbled from the saddle.
"Yes, oh yes," he cried. "Bold, valiant Gergi is glad to follow kindly master and noble princess with boatings and floatings."
They cantered down the slope and dismounted at the water's edge. Seeing them, the sailors ran a plank out from the vessel to the shore. No sooner had they done so than a young man clambered onto the plank and hastened with eager strides toward the companions. But he had taken only a few paces along the swaying board, when he lost his footing, stumbled,
and with a loud splash, pitched headlong into the shallows. Taran and Carl ran to help him, but the young man had already picked himself up and was awkwardly sloshing his way ashore. He was of Taran's age, with a moon-round face, pale blue eyes, and straw-coloured hair. He wore a sword and a small, richly ornamented dagger in a belt of silver links. His cloak and jacket, worked with threads of gold and silver, were now sopping wet. The stranger, however, appeared not the least dismayed either by his ducking or the sodden state of his garments. Instead, he grinned as cheerfully as if nothing whatever had befallen him.
"Hello! Hello!" he called, waving a dripping hand. "Is that Princess Ailanwy I see? Of course, it must be."
Without further ado, and without stopping even to wring out his cloak, he bowed so low that Taran feared the young man would lose his balance. Then he straightened up and in a solemn voice declared,
"On behalf of Rudlam, son of Rud, and Teleria, daughter of Tanwen, king and queen of the Isle of Mona, greetings to the Princess Ailanwy of the Royal House of Lyr, and to, well, to all the rest of you," he added, blinking rapidly as a thought suddenly occurred to him. "I should have asked your names before I started."
Taran, taken aback and not a little vexed by this scatterbrained behaviour, stepped forward and presented the companions. Before he could ask the stranger's name, the young man interrupted.
"Splendid! You must all introduce yourselves again later, one at a time. Otherwise, I might forget. Oh, I see the shipmaster's waving at us. Something to do with tides, no doubt. He's always very concerned with them. This is the first time I've commanded a voyage,"
he went on proudly.
"Amazing how easy it is. All you need to do is tell the sailors. But who are you?"
Taran asked, puzzled. The young man blinked at him.
"Did I forget to mention that? I'm Prince Rune."
"Prince Rune?" Taran repeated in a tone of disbelief.
"Quite so," answered Rune, smiling pleasantly. "King Rudlam's my father, and of course Queen Teleria's my mother. Shall we go aboard?
I should hate to upset the shipmaster, for he does worry about those tides."
Carl embraced Ailanwy.
"When we see you again," he told her, "I doubt we shall recognize you. You shall be a fine princess."
"I want to be recognized," Ailanwy cried. "I want to be me."
"Never fear," said Carl, winking.
He turned to Taran.
"And you, my boy, farewell. When you return, send Kaw ahead to tell me, and I shall meet you at the Averan Harbour."
Prince Rune, offering his arm to Ailanwy, led her across the plank. Gergi and Taran followed them. Having formed his own opinion of Rune's agility, Taran kept a wary eye on the prince until Ailanwy was safe aboard. The ship was surprisingly roomy and well-fitted. The deck was long, with benches for oarsmen on either side. At the stern rose a high, square shed topped by a platform. The sailors dipped their oars and worked the vessel to the middle of the river. Carl trotted along the bank and waved with all his might. The old warrior dropped from sight as the ship swung around a bend in the ever-widening river. Kaw had flapped to the masthead, and, as the breeze whistled through his feathers, he beat his wings so pridefully that he looked more like a black rooster than a crow. The shore turned grey in the distance, and the craft sped seaward. If Rune had perplexed and vaguely irritated him at their first meeting, Taran now began to wish he had never laid eyes on the prince. Taran had meant to speak with Ailanwy apart, for there was much in his heart he longed to tell her. Yet each time he ventured to do so, Prince Rune would pop up as if from nowhere, his round face beaming happily, calling out,
"Hello! Hello!"
A greeting Taran found more infuriating each time he heard it. Once, the Prince of Mona eagerly dashed up to show the companions a large fish he had caught, to the delight of Ailanwy and Gergi, but not Taran. For a moment later, Rune's attention turned elsewhere, and he hurried off, leaving Taran holding the wet, slippery fish in his arms. Another time, while leaning over the side to point out a school of dolphins, the prince nearly dropped his sword into the sea. Luckily, Taran caught it before the blade was lost forever. After the ship reached open water, Prince Roon decided to take a hand at steering. But he no sooner grasped the tiller than it flew out of his fingers. While Roon clutched at the wooden handle, the vessel lurched and slewed about so violently that Taran was flung against the bulwark. A water cask broke loose and went rolling down the deck. The sail flapped madly at the sudden change of course, and one bank of oars nearly snapped before the steersman regained the tiller from the undismayed prince. The painful bump on Taran's head did nothing to raise his esteem of Prince Roon's seamanship. Although the prince made no further attempt to steer the vessel, he climbed atop the platform, where he called out orders to the crew.
"Lash up the sail!" Roon shouted happily. "Steady the helm!"
No seaman himself, Taran nevertheless realized the sail was already tightly lashed, and the craft was moving unwaveringly through the water, and he very shortly became aware that the sailors were quietly going about their task of keeping the ship on course, without paying any heed whatever to the prince. Taran's head ached from the bump. His jacket was still unpleasantly damp and fishy, and when at last his chance came to speak with Ailanwy, he was altogether out of sorts.
"Prince of Mona, indeed," he muttered. "He's no more than a princeling, a clumsy, muddle-headed baby. Commanding the voyage? If the sailors listened to him, we'd be aground in no time. I've never sailed a ship, but I've no doubt I could do it better than he. I've never seen anyone so feckless."
"Feckless," answered Ailanwy. "He does often seem a little dense, but I'm sure he means well, and I've a feeling he has a good heart. In fact, I think he's rather nice."
"I suppose you do," Taran replied, all the more nettled by Alanwi's words. "Because he gave you his arm to lean on? A gallant princely gesture. Lucky he didn't pitch you over the side."
"It was polite, at least," Ailanwy remarked, "which is something assistant pig-keepers sometimes aren't."
"An assistant pig-keeper," Taran snapped. "Yes, that's to be my lot in life. I was born to be one, just as the princeling of Mona was born to his rank. He's a king's son, and I don't even know the names of my parents."
"Well," said Ailanwy, "you can't blame Roon for being born. I mean, you could, but it wouldn't help matters. It's like kicking a rock with your bare foot."
Taran snorted.
"I dare say that's his father's sword he's got on, and I dare say he's never drawn it except to frighten a rabbit. At least I've earned the right to wear mine. Yet he still calls himself a prince. Does his birth make him worthy of his rank? As worthy as Gwydion, son of Don?"
"Prince Gwydion's the greatest warrior in Prydain," Ailanwy replied. "You can't expect everyone to be like him. And it seems to me that if an assistant pig-keeper does the best he can, and a prince does the best he can, there's no difference between them."
"No difference," Taran cried angrily. "You spoke well enough of Roon."
"Taran of Caer Dalbyn," Ailanwy declared. "I really believe you're jealous. And sorry for yourself. And that's as ridiculous as painting your nose green."
Taran said no more, but turned away and stared glumly at the water. To make matters worse, the wind freshened, the sea heaved about the sides of the ship, and Taran could barely keep his footing. His head spun, and he feared the vessel would capsize. Ailanwy, deathly pale, clung to the bulwark. Gurgi wailed and howled pitifully.
"Poor Tenderhead is full of whirlings and twirlings. Gurgi does not like this ship any more. He wants to be at home."
Prince Roon appeared not the least distressed. He ate heartily and was in the best of spirits, while Taran huddled wretchedly in his cloak. The sea did not calm until dusk, and at nightfall Taran was grateful the vessel anchored in a calm cove. Ailanwy took out the golden sphere. In her hands it began to glow, and its rays shimmered over the black water.
"I say, what's that?"
cried Prince Roon, who had clambered down from his platform.
"It's my bauble," said Ailanwy. "I always carry it with me. You never can tell when it will come in handy."
"Amazing!" exclaimed the prince. "I've never seen anything like it in my life."
He examined the golden ball carefully, but as he held it in his hand, the light winked out. Roon looked up in dismay.
"I'm afraid I've broken it."
"No,"
Ailanwy assured him. It's just that it doesn't work for everyone.
Unbelievable, said Rune. You must show it to my parents. I wish we had a few of those trinkets around the castle.
After a last curious glance at the bauble, Rune returned it to Ailanwy. Insisting that the princess sleep in the comfort of the shed, Rune bedded himself down amid a pile of netting. Gurgi curled up nearby, while Kor, heedless of Taran's entreaties to leave his high perch, roosted on the mast. Rune, falling asleep instantly, snored so piercingly that Taran, already vexed beyond endurance, stretched out on the deck as far as possible from the slumbering prince. When Taran slept at last, he dreamed the companions had never left Caer Dalban. Chapter 2 Dinas Ridnant. The days that followed put Taran in better spirits. The companions grew used to the motion of the ship. The air was clear, sharp, and salt-laden, and Taran could taste the briny spray on his lips. While Prince Rune, from atop his platform, shouted commands which the crew, as usual, did not heed, the companions were glad to pass the time by lending a hand at the tasks aboard. The work, as Carl had foretold, eased Taran's heart. Yet there came moments when he suddenly recalled the purpose of the voyage, and wished it would never end. He had just finished coiling a length of rope when Kor swooped down from the mast and circled around him, croaking wildly. An instant later the lookout cried he had sighted land. At Prince Rune's urging, the companions hastened to climb to the platform. In the bright morning, Taran saw the hills of Mona spring from the horizon. The vessel sped closer to the crescent-shaped harbour of Dinas Ridnant, with its piers and jetties, its stone seawall, and clusters of ships. Steep cliffs rose almost from the water's edge, and on the highest of them stood a tall castle. From it, the banners of the House of Rudlam snapped in the breeze. The vessel glided to the pier. The sailors cast the mooring lines and leapt ashore. The companions, with Prince Rune marching in the lead, were escorted to the castle by ranks of warriors who made a hedge of honour with their spears. Yet even this short journey did not end without mishap. The Prince of Mona, drawing his sword to return the salute of the Captain of Guards, did so with such a sweeping gesture that the point snagged in Taran's cloak.
"I say, I'm sorry about that," cried Rune, curiously examining the long, gaping slash his blade had caused.
"And I too, Prince of Mona," Taran muttered, vexed at Rune and embarrassed at the impression his torn garment would make on the king and queen. He said no more, but shut his lips and desperately hoped the damage would go unnoticed. The procession passed through the castle gates and into a wide courtyard. Shouting a glad, "Hello! Hello!" Prince Rune hurried to his waiting parents. King Rudlam had the same round and cheerful face as Prince Rune. He greeted the companions cordially, repeating himself a number of times. If he was aware of Taran's torn cloak, he showed no sign, which only added to Taran's distress. When King Rudlam at last finished talking, Queen Teleria stepped forward. The queen was a stout, pleasant-looking woman dressed in fluttering white garments. A golden circlet crowned her braided hair, which was the same straw colour as Prince Rune's. She showered Ailanwy with kisses, embraced the still embarrassed Taran, halted in amazement when she came to Gurgi, but embraced him nevertheless.
"Welcome, daughter of Angarad," Queen Teleria began, returning to Ailanwy. "Your presence honours—"
"Don't fidget, child, and stand straight.
Our royal house—"
The queen stopped suddenly and took Ailanwy by the shoulders.
"Good Lyr," she cried. "Where did you get those frightful clothes?"
"Yes, I can see it's high time Dalban let you out of that hole and corner in the middle of the woods."
"Hole and corner, indeed," Ailanwy cried. "I love Caer Dalban, and Dalban is a great enchanter."
"Exactly," said Queen Teleria. "He's so busy casting spells and all such that he's let you grow like a weed."
She turned to King Rudlam.
"Wouldn't you say so, my dear?"
"Very much like a weed,"
agreed the king, eyeing Kor with interest. The crow hunched up his wings, opened his beak, and loudly croaked,
"Rudlam!"
to the king's immense delight. Queen Teleria, meanwhile, had been examining Taran and Gurgi by turns.
Look at that disgracefully torn cloak. You must both have new raiment, she declared. New jackets, new sandals, everything. Luckily, we have a perfectly wonderful shoemaker at the castle now. He was just... Don't pout that way, my child. You'll give yourself a blister. Passing through. But we've kept him busy, and he's still cobbling away. Our chief steward shall see to it. Mag, she called. Mag, where is he?
At your command, answered the chief steward, who had been standing all the while by Queen Teleria's elbow. He wore one of the finest cloaks Taran had ever seen, its rich embroidery almost surpassing King Rudlam's garment. Mag carried a long staff of polished wood, taller than himself. From his neck hung a chain of heavy silver links, and at his belt was a huge iron ring, from which jingled keys of all sizes.
"All has been ordered," said Mag, bowing deeply. "Your decision has been foreseen. The shoemaker, the tailors, and the weavers stand ready."
"Excellent!" Queen Teleria cried. "Now the princess and I shall go first to the weaving rooms, and Mag shall show the rest of you to your chambers."
Mag bowed again, even more deeply, and beckoned with his staff. With Gergi at his heels, Taran followed the chief steward through the courtyard, into a high stone building and down a vaulted corridor. At the end of it, Mag gestured toward an open portal and silently withdrew. Taran stepped inside. The chamber was small, but neat and airy, bright with sunlight from a narrow casement. Fragrant rushes covered the floor, and in one corner stood a low couch and pallet of straw. Taran had no sooner taken off his cloak when the portal suddenly burst open and a spiky yellow head thrust in.
"Fluda Flam!"
Taran shouted with joyful surprise at the sight of this long-absent companion.
"Well met!"
The bard seized Taran by the hand and began pumping it with all his might, at the same time clapping him resoundingly on the shoulder. Kor flapped his wings while Gergi leapt into the air, yelped at the top of his voice, and embraced Fluda in a shower of twigs, leaves, and shedding hair.
"Well, well, well," said the bard, "and high time it is. I've been waiting for you. I thought you'd never get here."
"How did you come?" cried Taran, who had just begun to catch his breath. "How did you know we were to be at Dinas Ridnant?"
"Why, I couldn't help," the bard replied, beaming with delight. "There's been talk of nothing but the Princess Alanwi. Where is she, by the way? I must find her and pay my respects at once. I was hoping Dalban would send you along with her. How is he? How is Carl? I see you've brought Kor. Great Belin, I've seen none of you for so long I've lost track."
"But Fluda," Taran interrupted, "what brings you to Mona of all places?"
"Well, it's a short tale," said the bard. "I had decided this time really to make a go of being a king. And so I did, for the best part of a year. Then along came spring and the barding and wandering season, and everything indoors began looking unspeakably dreary, and everything outdoors began somehow pulling at me, and next thing I knew I was on my way. I'd never been to Mona, so that was the best reason in the world for going. I reached Dinas Ridnant a week ago. The vessel had already left to meet you, or you can be sure I'd have been on it."
"And you can be sure you'd have borne us better company than the princeling of Mona," Taran said. "We were lucky that noble fool didn't somehow manage to blunder onto a reef and sink us in the tide."
"But what of Doli?" he went on. "I have longed to see him as much as I have longed to see you."
"Good old Doli!" the bard chuckled, shaking his yellow head. "I tried to rouse him when I first set out, but he's hidden himself away with his kinsmen in the realm of the fair folk."
Fluda sighed.
"I fear our good dwarf has lost his taste for adventure. I managed to get word to him, thinking he might come along with me for the sport of it. He sent back a message. All it said was, 'Humph!'"
"You should have come to meet us at the harbour," Taran said. "It would have cheered me to know you were here."
"Ah, yes, I was going to," replied Fluda with some hesitation. "But I thought I'd wait and surprise you. I was busy, too, getting ready a song about the arrival of the princess.
Quite an impressive chant, if I do say so myself. We're all mentioned in it, with plenty of heroic deeds.
And Gurgi too, cried Gurgi.
Of course, said the bard, I shall sing it for all of you this evening.
Gurgi shouted and clapped his hands.
Gurgi cannot wait to hear hummings and strummings.
You shall hear them, old friend, the bard assured him, all in due course. But you can imagine, I could hardly spare the time to join the welcoming procession.
At this, a harp string broke suddenly. Fludur unslung his beloved instrument and looked at it ruefully.
There it goes again, he sighed. These beastly strings will never leave off snapping whenever I, add a little to the truth. And in this case, the truth of the matter is, I wasn't invited.
But a bard of the harp is honored at every court in Prydain, Tarin said. How could they overlook? Fludur raised a hand.
True, true, he said. I was certainly honored here, and handsomely, too. That was before they learned I wasn't a real bard. Afterward, he admitted, I was moved into the stables.
You should have told them you were a king, said Tarin.
No, no, said Fludur, shaking his head. When I'm a bard, I'm a bard. And when I'm a king, that's something else again. I never mix the two. King Rudlam and Queen Teleria are decent sorts, Fludur continued. The chief steward was the one who had me turned out.
Are you sure there wasn't some mistake? Tarin asked. From what I've seen of him, he seems to do his duties perfectly.
All too well, if you ask me, said Fludur. Somehow he found out about my qualifications, and next thing I knew, into the stables. The truth of it is, I think he hates music. Surprising how many people I've run into who, for some reason or other, simply can't abide harp playing.
Tarin heard a loud rapping at the portal. It was Mag himself, come with the shoemaker, who stood humbly behind him.
"Not that he troubles me," Fludur whispered.
"That is," he added, looking at the harp,
"not beyond what I can honourably bear."
He slung the instrument over his shoulder.
"Yes, well, as I was saying, I must go and find Princess Ailanwy. We shall meet later, in the stables, if you don't mind, and I shall play my new song."
Glaring at Mag, Fludur strode from the chamber. The chief steward, taking no notice of the bard's angry glance, bowed to Tarin.
"As Queen Teleria commanded, you and your companion are to be given new apparel. The shoemaker will serve you as you wish."
Tarin sat down on a wooden stool, and as Mag departed from the chamber, the shoemaker drew near. The man was bent with age and garbed most shabbily. A grimy cloth was wrapped around his head, and a fringe of grey hair fell almost to his shoulders. At his broad belt hung curiously shaped knives, awls, and hanks of thongs. Kneeling before Tarin, he opened a great sack and thrust in his hand to pull out strips of leather, which he placed about him on the floor. He squinted at his findings, holding up one after the other, then casting it aside.
"We must use the best, the best," he croaked, in a voice much like Kor's. "Only that will do. To go well shod is half the journey,"
he chuckled.
"Is that not so, eh? Is that not so, Tarin of Caer Dalban?"
Tarin drew back with a start. The shoemaker's tone had suddenly rung differently. He stared down at the aged man who had picked up a piece of leather and was now shaping it deftly with a crooked little knife. The shoemaker, his face as tanned as his own materials, was watching him steadily. Gurgi looked ready to yelp loudly. The man raised a finger to his lips. Tarin, in confusion, hurriedly knelt before the shoemaker.
"Lord Gwydion!"
Gwydion's eyes flashed with pleasure, but his smile was grim.
"Hear me well," he said quickly in a hushed voice. "Should we be interrupted? I shall find a way to speak with you later. Tell no one who I am. What you must know, above all, is this. The life of the Princess Ailanwy is in danger."
And so, he added, is your own. Chapter 3 The Shoemaker. Taran paled. His head still whirled at seeing the Prince of Don in the guise of a shoemaker, and Gwydion's words left him all the more confused. "Our lives in danger?" he asked hurriedly. "Does Aron of Anuvin seek us as far as Dinas Ridnant?" Gwydion motioned for Gurgi to stand guard at the portal, and turned once more to Taran. "No," said Gwydion, with a quick shake of his head, "though Aron's wrath has grown to fury since the Black Cauldron was destroyed, the threat comes not from Anuvin." Taran frowned. "Who, then? There is none in Dinas Ridnant who wishes us ill. You cannot mean that King Rudlam or Queen Teleria—" "The House of Rudlam has always borne friendship to the sons of Don, and to our High King Math," replied Gwydion. "Look elsewhere, Taran of Caer Dalbyn."
"But who would harm Ilanwy?"
Taran asked urgently. "It is known she is under Dalbyn's protection." "There is one who would dare to stand against Dalbyn," Gwydion said, "one against whom my own powers may not suffice, and whom I fear as much as Aron himself." Gwydion's face was taut, and his green eyes flickered with deep anger as he spoke one harsh word.
"Akron."
Taran's heart chilled.
"No," he whispered. "No, that evil enchantress is dead."
"So I, too, believed," Gwydion answered. "It is not true. Akron lives."
"She has not rebuilt Spiral Castle,"
Taran cried, his thoughts flashing to the dungeon where Akron had held him prisoner.
"Spiral Castle still lies in ruins, as you left it," Gwydion said, "and grass already covers it. Ethaneth, where Akron would have given me to death, no longer stands. I have journeyed to those places and seen with my own eyes." "You must know that I have long pondered her fate," Gwydion went on. "Of Akron there has not been the slightest sign, as though the earth had swallowed her. This troubled me and lay heavily on my heart, and I have never given up seeking traces of her." "At last I found these traces," said Gwydion. "They were faint as words whispered in the wind, puzzling rumours that seemed at first no more than imaginings. A senseless riddle without an answer." "Perhaps," Gwydion continued, "I should say an answer without a riddle. And it was only after long toil and hard journeying that I discovered part of that riddle. Alas, only a part."
Gwydion's voice lowered. As he spoke, his hands did not cease carving and shaping the unfinished sandal.
"What I have learned is this. After Spiral Castle fell, Akron vanished. At first I believed she had sought refuge in the realm of Anuvin, for she had lived long as a consort of Aron. Indeed, it was Akron who gave Aron his power in the days when she herself ruled Prydain. But she did not go to Anuvin. Since she had let the sword Durnwin slip from her hands and failed to take my life, it may be that she feared Aron's wrath. Perhaps she dared not face him, having been outwitted by a young girl and an assistant pig-keeper. Of this I am not certain. Nevertheless, she fled Prydain. Since then, no man knows what has befallen her. Yet even to know she is alive is cause enough for fear."
"Do you think she is on Mona?" Taran asked. "Does she seek vengeance on us? But Ilanwy was no more than a child when she escaped from Akron. She understood nothing of what she did."
"Wittingly or not, by taking Durnwin from Spiral Castle, Ilanwy gave Akron her most grievous defeat," Gwydion said. "Akron does not forget or forgive."
He knit his brows.
"It is my fear that she seeks Ilanwy, not only for revenge. I sense there is something other than that. It is hidden from me now, yet I must discover it without delay. More than Ilanwy's life may hang in the balance."
"If only Dalbyn had let her stay with us," Taran said in dismay. "He, too, must have known Akron was alive. Did he not realize Ilanwy would be in danger the moment she was beyond his protection?"
"Dalbyn's ways are deep," said Gwydion, "and not always given to me to fathom. He knows much, but he foresenses more than he chooses to tell."
Gwydion, putting down his awl, drew out a leather thong and began stitching it through the sandal. "Dalbyn sent me word that the Princess Ilanwy would voyage to Mona, and counseled me to turn my attention here. He told me, too, of certain other matters. But it is better not to speak of them now.
I cannot sit idle while Ilanwe may be in peril, Taran insisted. Is there no way I can serve you?
You shall serve me best by keeping silent, Gwydion answered. Stay watchful. Say nothing of me, or of what we have spoken. Not to the Princess Ilanwe, not even to Fluda. He smiled. Our eager bard saw me in the stables, and luckily did not know me. Meantime, I shall... Before the Prince of Dawn could finish, Gergi began waving his arms in warning. Footsteps rang in the corridor, and Gwydion bent quickly to the task of fitting the sandals.
"Hello! Hello!"
cried Prince Rune, striding into the chamber.
"Ah, Shoemaker, there you are!
Have you done with your work?"
"I say, they are handsome, aren't they?"
he said, glancing at the sandals.
"Amazingly well made!
I should like a pair myself. Oh, my mother asks to see you in the Great Hall," he added, turning to Taran.
Gwydion's face had fallen suddenly into lines and wrinkles. His shoulders were hunched, and his voice shook with age. Without a further glance at Taran, Gwydion beckoned to Rune.
"Come with me, young prince," he said. "You shall have sandals befitting your station."
As Kor fluttered after him, Taran hurried from the chamber and down the corridor. Gergi, round-eyed with fright, trotted beside him.
"Oh, fearsome danger!" Gergi moaned. "Gergi is sorry, great enchanter, sends us to place of peril. Gergi wants to hide his poor tender head under kindly straw at Caer Dalban."
Taran warned him to silence. "Ilanwe is surely in more danger than we are," he whispered, hastening toward the great hall. "I don't like the thought of Akron turning up again any more than you do, but Gwydion is here to protect Ilanwe, and so are we."
"Yes, yes," cried Gergi. "Brave, loyal Gergi will guard golden-haired princess, too. Oh, yes, and she will be safe with him, but,"
he snuffled,
"he still longs to be in Caer Dalban."
"Take heart, my friend," Taran said. He smiled and put a hand on Gergi's trembling shoulder. "We companions shall see no ill befalls any of us. But remember, not a word that Gwydion is here. He has his own plans, and we must do nothing to betray them."
"Gergi will be silent,"
Gergi cried, clapping his hands to his mouth.
"Oh, yes, but mind," he added, shaking a finger at Kor, "that gossipy blackbird does not tell with talkings and squawkings."
"Silence,"
Kor croaked, bobbing his head.
"Secrets."
In the high-ceilinged great hall, with its flagstones that seemed to cover a space as large as the orchard at Caer Dalban, Taran caught sight of Ilanwe amid a group of court ladies. Some of Ilanwe's age were listening delightedly to the princess. The rest, all of whom looked much like Queen Teleria, were frowning or whispering behind their hands. Mag, standing near the queen's throne, watched impassively.
"And there we stood," Ilanwe was saying, her eyes flashing, "back to back, sword in hand. The huntsmen of Anuvin burst from the forest. They were upon us in a moment."
The young girls of the court gasped with excitement, while some of the older women gave horrified cluckings that reminded Taran of nothing so much as Carl's chicken run. Taran saw that Ilanwe wore a new cloak. Her hair had been combed and dressed in a different fashion. Among the ladies, she shone like a bird of golden plumage, and, with a curious twinge of heart, Taran realized that, had it not been for her chattering, he might not have known her.
"Good Lyr,"
cried Queen Teleria, who had leapt from her throne as Ilanwe continued the tale of battle.
"I am beginning to think you haven't had a... My dear child, don't be so gleeful when you talk about hacking at people with swords. Safe moment in your life."
She blinked, shook her head, and fanned herself with a kerchief.
"What relief that Dalban has finally decided to be sensible and send you to us. If nothing else, you'll be out of harm's way."
Taran caught his breath, and it took all his strength to force himself not to shout Gwydion's warning aloud.
"Ah, there you are," Queen Teleria called, spying Taran. "I had thought to speak to you about... That's right, young man, step up briskly, bow a little more deeply if you can, and, good Lyr, don't scowl so.
the royal feast tonight. You shall be pleased to know that, in honour of all of you, we're planning to invite a perfectly wonderful bard, who claims to be a bard, that is, and who claims, by the way, to know you."
"The self-styled bard," said Mag, with ill-concealed distaste at the mention of Fluda, "has already been commanded to present himself at the feast."
"Therefore, in the matter of new garments," Teleria went on, "you had better go with Mag immediately and find some."
"That has been seen to as well, Lady Teleria," murmured the chief steward, handing Taran a neatly folded cloak and jacket.
"Wonderful!" Teleria cried. "All that remains to be done is—" "Well, I do believe everything has been done. I suggest, then, Taran of Caer Dalban, that you go and make yourself— don't frown so, you'll look old before your time— ready."
Taran hardly had finished bowing to Queen Teleria when Alanwi seized him and Gergi by the arms and hastily drew them away.
"You've seen Fluda, of course," she whispered. "Now it's getting to be more like old times. What a blessing to have him here. I've never met such silly women. Why, I don't think there's one of them that's ever drawn a sword. All they want to talk about is sewing and embroidery and weaving and how to run a castle. The ones who have husbands are always complaining about them, and the ones who haven't are always complaining about the lack of them. They've never been out of Dinas Ridnant in their lives. I told them a thing or two about some of our adventures. Not the best ones. I'm saving those for later, when you can be there to tell your part in them."
"What we'll do," Ailanwy hurried on, her eyes sparkling, "after the feast, when no one's watching, we'll get hold of Fluda and go exploring for a few days. They'll never miss us. There's so many people coming and going around here. There's bound to be a few adventures on Mona, but we certainly won't find them in this stupid castle. Now, first thing, you must look out a sword for me. I wish I'd brought one from Caer Dalban. Not that I think we'll need swords, but it's better to have them just in case. Gergi, of course, shall bring along his wallet of food."
"Ailanwy," Taran interrupted, "this cannot be."
"How's that?" asked Ailanwy. "Oh, very well. You needn't bother with swords, then. We'll just go adventuring as we are."
She hesitated.
"What's the matter with you? I must say, you have the strangest expressions on your face from time to time. Right now, you look as if a mountain were about to fall on your head. As I was saying—"
"Ailanwy," Taran said firmly, "you are not to leave Dinas Ridnant."
Ailanwy, so surprised, she stopped talking for a moment, stared at him, open-mouthed.
"What?" she cried. "What did you say? Not leave the castle? Taran of Caer Dalban, I think the salt air must have pickled your wits."
"Listen to me," Taran said gravely, searching his mind for some means to warn the startled girl without revealing Gwydion's secret. "Dinas Ridnant is unfamiliar to us. We know nothing of Mona. There may be dangers that we—"
"Dangers?" cried Ailanwy. "You can be sure of that. And the biggest is that I'll be bored to tears. Don't think for an instant I mean to wear out my days in this castle. You, of all people, tell me I'm not to go adventuring. What really is the matter with you? I'm ready to believe you dropped your courage over the side of Rune's ship, along with the anchor stone."
"It's not a question of courage," Taran began. "It is the better part of wisdom to—"
"Now you're talking about wisdom," Ailanwy cried. "Before, that was the last thing in the world you thought about."
"This is different," Taran said. "Can you not understand?" he pleaded, though he saw clearly from Ailanwy's face that his words made no sense to her. For an instant, he was tempted to blurt out the truth. Instead, he took the girl by the shoulders.
"You are not to set foot outside this place," he ordered angrily. "And if I think you have any idea of doing so, I shall ask King Rudlam to set a guard over you."
"What?" cried Ailanwy. "How dare you?"
Tears suddenly filled her eyes.
"Yes, I do understand. You're glad I've been sent to this wretched island and these clucking hens. You couldn't wait for a chance to be rid of me. You actually want me to stay here and be lost in this dreadful castle. That's worse than putting someone's head in a sack of feathers."
Sobbing, Ailanwy stamped her foot.
"Taran of Caer Dalban,
I'm not speaking to you any more.
Chapter 4 Shadows. The feast that evening was surely the merriest the castle had ever seen. Cor, perched on the back of Taran's chair, bobbed up and down and looked as if the banquet had been arranged entirely in his honour. King Rudlam beamed with good spirits. The talk and laughter of the guests rang through the great hall. Behind the long table, crowded with Queen Teleria's ladies of the court, Mag flitted back and forth, snapping his fingers and whispering commands to servitors bearing endless dishes of food and flagons of drink. For Taran, it was a waking nightmare. He sat silent and uneasy, his repast untouched.
"You needn't look so gloomy," said Ailanwy. "After all, you aren't the one who has to stay here. If I'm trying to make the best of things, I must say you're not exactly helpful. I want to remind you I'm still not speaking to you after the way you behaved today."
Without waiting to hear Taran's confused protests, Ailanwy tossed her head and began chattering to Prince Roon. Taran bit his lip. He felt as though he were shouting a voiceless warning, while Ailanwy, all unwitting, raced gaily toward the brink of a cliff. At the end of the feasting, Fluder tuned his harp, stepped to the middle of the hall, and sang his new lay. Taran listened without pleasure, although he realized it was the best Fluder had yet composed. When the bard had done, and King Rudlam had begun to yawn, the guests rose from their seats at the table. Taran plucked Fluder's sleeve and drew him aside. "I've been thinking about the stables," Taran said anxiously. "No matter what Mag says, it's not a fitting place for you to sleep. I'll speak to King Rudlam, and I'm sure he'll order Mag to give you back your chamber in the castle." Taran hesitated. I think somehow it would be better if we were all together. We are strangers here, and know nothing of the ways of this place."
"Great Belin, don't give yourself a moment's concern about that," replied the bard. "For my part, I prefer the stables. Indeed, that's one reason I go wandering, to get away from stuffy, dreary castles. Besides," he added behind his hand, "it would lead to trouble with Mag, and if he pushes me beyond endurance, there will be swordplay. A flam is hot-headed, which is hardly courteous behaviour from a guest. No, no, we shall all be fine and meet again in the morning."
So saying, Fluder shouldered his harp, waved good-night, and made his way from the hall. "Something tells me we should keep an eye on the castle," Taran said to Gergi. He put a forefinger under Kor's feet and set the bird on Gergi's shoulder, where the crow immediately began running his beak through Gergi's matted hair. "Stay close to Ailanwy's chamber," he went on. "I'll join you soon. Keep Kor with you, and send him to me if anything seems amiss." Gergi nodded.
"Yes, yes," he whispered. "Loyal Gergi will stand with watchful waitings. He will guard dreamful drowsings of noble princess."
Unnoticed among the departing guests, Taran walked to the courtyard. Hoping to find Gwydion, he strode quickly toward the stables. Stars filled the clear night sky, and a bright moon hung above the crags of Mona. In the stables, Taran discovered no trace of the Prince of Dawn, but came only upon Fluder, curled up in the straw, his arm flung around his harp, and already snoring peacefully. Taran turned once more to the castle, which had by now fallen into darkness. He stood for a moment, wondering where else he might seek.
"Hello! Hello!"
Prince Roon burst from around a corner at such a rate he nearly sent Taran sprawling.
"Still awake, are you? So am I. My mother says it's good for me to take a little stroll before sleeping. I suppose you're doing the same. Very good. We shall walk along together."
"That we shall not," Taran retorted. Now of all times he had no wish to be hindered by the feckless prince.
I seek the tailors," he added quickly. "Where are they lodged?" "You're looking for tailors?" Roon asked. "How odd. Whatever for?"
"My jacket," Taran hurriedly answered. It fits me badly. I must ask them to fix it."
"In the middle of the night?" asked Roon, his moon face puzzled. "Now that really is surprising."
He pointed toward a shadowed side of the castle.
"Their chambers are down there.
But I shouldn't think they'd be in a humour to stitch well if you rouse them up out of a sleep. Tailors can be touchy, you know. I advise you to wait until morning.
No, it must be done now, Darren said, impatient to be rid of Roon. The prince shrugged, wished him a cheerful good night, and trotted off again. Taran made his way toward a cluster of sheds beyond the stable. His search there was also in vain. Discouraged, he had decided to rejoin Gergi when he stopped suddenly. A figure was moving quickly across the courtyard, not toward the main portal, but to the farthest angle of the heavy stone wall. Could Ilanwe have slipped away from Gergi? Taran was about to call out. Then, fearful of waking the castle, he hurried after the figure. An instant later it seemed to disappear completely. Taran pressed on. At the wall, he stumbled upon a narrow opening, barely wide enough to squeeze through. Taran plunged through the curtain of ivy concealing it, and found himself beyond the castle, on a rocky slope overlooking the harbour. The figure, Taran suddenly realized, was not Ilanwe. Too tall, the gait different. He caught his breath as the cloaked shape turned once for a furtive glance at the castle, and the moonlight glittered for a moment over its features. It was Mag. Spider-like, the chief steward was rapidly picking his way down a path. In a surge of fear and suspicion, Taran clambered blindly over jagged stones, trying his best to be both swift and silent. Despite the clear night, the way was difficult to follow. Boulders loomed to catch him unawares and break his stride. He longed for the light of Ilanwe's bauble as he scrambled headlong after Mag toward the sleeping harbour. Mag had come to level ground well ahead of Taran, and was scuttling along the seawall until, at the far end, he reached a huge pile of rocks. With surprising agility, the chief steward swung himself up, crawled over, and once more dropped out of sight. Casting caution aside, fearful he would lose track of Mag, Taran broke into a run. Along the wall, moonbright water lapped and whispered. A shadow moved for an instant among the stilted piers. In alarm, Taran checked his pace, then hastened on. His eyes were playing tricks. Even the rocks themselves seemed to rise before him like crouching, threatening beasts. Gritting his teeth, Taran climbed the dark barrier of rocks. Below, the water churned in glittering eddies and foamed among the stones. The surf rang in his ears as he hauled himself to the crest. There he clung, not daring to follow farther. Mag had stopped not many paces beyond, at the edge of a narrow spit of land. Taran saw him kneel and make a rapid motion. In another instant, a light flared. The chief steward had lit a torch, and now raised it overhead, moving the flickering flame slowly back and forth. As Taran watched, fearful and puzzled, a tiny point of orange light glowed far seaward. This answering signal, Taran judged, could come only from a ship, though he could make out nothing of the vessel's shape or distance. Mag waved the torch again, in a different pattern. The light from the ship repeated it, then winked out. Mag thrust his torch into the black water, where it sputtered and died. He turned and strode quickly toward the tumble of rocks where Taran lay. Taran, left blinking in the sudden darkness, sought to clamber down before Mag should come upon him, but could find no foothold. In panic, he groped for a jutting stone below him, slipped, caught vainly for another one. He could hear Mag scrambling up the far side and let himself fall among the rocks. Wincing at the sharp pain, he tried to hide in the shadows. Mag's head had just appeared at the crest when Taran was seized firmly from behind. Taran snatched at his sword. A hand was clapped over his mouth, stifling his shout, and he was dragged rapidly toward the foaming wavelets to be flung silently down amid the stones.
"Make no sound," Gwydion's voice whispered the command.
Taran went limp with relief. Overhead, Mag lowered himself from the mass of stones and passed no more than a dozen paces from the two crouching figures. Gwydion, clinging to the rocks above the surf, motioned for Taran to stay hidden. The chief steward, without a backward glance, hastened once more along the seawall, heading for the castle.
"Seize him!" Taran urged. "A ship rides at anchor. I saw him signal it. We must make him tell us what he is about."
Gwydion shook his head. His green eyes followed the retreating Mag, and his lips drew tightly against his teeth in the lean smile of a stalking wolf. He He still wore the rags of the shoemaker, but Durnwin, the black sword, now hung at his belt.
"Let him go," he murmured. "The game is not played out."
"But the signal," Taran began. Gwydion nodded.
"I, too, saw it. I have been keeping watch over the castle since I left you.